Hi, I'm Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. An important and engaging book is the new book from author Andrew McLeod. The award-winning journalist and legislative bureau chief for the TIE.ca has written A Better Place on Earth, The Search for Fairness in Super Unequal British Columbia. He writes of how inequality has risen in this province to the point where BC now has the highest rate of inequality in Canada, the rich are getting richer, to a point where the top 10% have more than half the wealth. For the rest of the province, income is stagnant. Now, this might seem like a problem throughout the world, so I'll ask Mr. McLeod, who joins me now, about what sets BC apart. He's done a lot of research. He's interviewed politicians, economists, activists, and policymakers, as well as single parents, those struggling to live on disability assistance, as well as wage workers who, despite more than 40 hours a week, can't make ends meet, not to mention don't have savings or a house. What does all this inequality mean for a province that still considers itself the best place on earth? The book also has some solutions, and we'll look at those too. The book is from Harbor Publishing. Please welcome to the Plante Online program in Victoria, BC today, Andrew McLeod. Mr. McLeod, good morning.
Hi, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
We'll get to the book in just a sec, but because your publication is in the news as of late, a week or so ago, the editorial leadership changed at the TIE, and there was news this week of some litigation that's been put forward by the former editor of the TIE. Is there anything that you'd want to say as to how it's going at the TIE? I mean, you're there, you're an employee there, you run the bureau there in Victoria.
I've worked for them for 7 years, and I freelanced for them before that, and it's been a great place to work, and the book that we're talking about today wouldn't exist without the TIE. There's been some changeover. I can't really add anything other than what the TIE said publicly, which was that we thank Jane Armstrong for her service since October and wish her well in future endeavors. And Robin Smith, who's been around for a while as the managing editor, is going to step in an acting role to get us through the next little while anyway. So I think that's been said publicly. I think the province reported that Jane had filed a notice of claim in court, and I don't know anything about that. And I think any questions about it should probably go to, well, either Jane or to the TIE head office.
So, but for those of us who have become fans of the TIE, who enjoy the writing and your work, the publication will continue regardless of all the stuff that's happening in the news, right?
I expect so. Nobody has told me otherwise.
Yeah.
I work in Victoria. Most people I work with are in Vancouver, and from where I sit, things seem to carry on pretty much as normal. So I assume it's going to continue doing that.
By the way, when I either see you on television or hear you on the radio, you're described as the legislative bureau chief. How big's the bureau there in Victoria?
I think it was the Columbia Review of Journalism who a couple of years ago came out with a position that people who are on their own in bureaus shouldn't really be described as bureau chief. And I'm definitely in that situation. And there was discussion when I started about whether to describe me as, news reporter, political reporter, BC politics reporter. But they went with legislative bureau chief in the end. And I don't know if it was aspirational that perhaps one day there would be more people in the bureau, but it's just me.
Yeah.
And I'm not alone that way. Keith Baldry's the bureau chief for the global,
and
I'm not sure what Rob Shaw's title at the Sun is these days, but Jonathan Fowley before him was the bureau chief, and again, they were on their own as well.
Now, this book, as I said in the introduction, it's quite an engaging book, and at times when one reads it, it's just stunned at the figures you provide. But less people think that it's all bleak. There is some hope in the book. But let's talk about what's wrong in British Columbia. I get the sense that it's the last 15 years, say, since this Liberal government has been in power, this Liberal Party, I should say, has been in power, that it seemed to, that we see these gulfs in between the rich and the poor.
I think it goes back further. I think BC is part of a trend that is Canada-wide, North American-wide, even global. When you go back to sort of the 1970s, and inequality sort of hit a low, and then it sort of ticked up through the 80s and 90s, and then most places it sort of plateaued a bit after that. BC, I mean, I think there's I'm not a huge fan of charts, but there's an interesting one for the Gini coefficient in BC, where you sort of see us, you know, going up with the Canadian average through the 90s, and then 2001, which of course is when the government changed, there's a spike where we go sort of way up above the Canadian average. So I do think there's an interesting question of well, why is that, and why has BC's pattern been a little different than other places? But it didn't start in 2001. It was a trend that was going on for quite a while here and elsewhere. But I would say it got amplified after 2001.
And if you talk to, say former Premier Campbell or the current Premier, Christy Clark, can they justify what's gone on in this province since then?
I think that's sort of the political discourse that we live in, right? Like, Christy Clark is very clear that they are the party of, you know, shrink taxes and grow the economy. They're not the government of, you know, spend more money on people in need. Gordon Campbell was the same. You know, he was, his line was, you know, the best social program is a job. You know, it's fine as far as it goes for the people who have jobs, but it's not enough. You know, there are a lot of people who are left out of the labor market or who don't, you know, make enough money in the job they have, either working at minimum wage or not with enough hours to, you know, live in what's a very expensive place. So I don't think they really justify it, other than that they run campaigns on low taxes and when they win, they have to pay for that somehow. So you know, in some ways we have gotten what we voted for here.
But I'm sure if you ask the Premier today, she would probably say that the province isn't unequal, or to the degree that you probably say in the book. I mean, do you think she'd agree with the book, say?
I don't think she would argue with the statistics. I mean, the statistics all come from Statistics Canada. I don't think anyone's suggesting they're wrong. You know, it's very clear that that inequality has grown for three decades. I don't know anybody who argues with that. Where you get the argument is whether it's worth doing anything about it. You know, does it matter, and should we act on it?
And what have you seen from this government in terms of acting on it?
Recently, some stuff around the edges. You know, they have raised minimum wage a little bit. You know, it was frozen at $8 an hour through from about 2001 to 2011, I think, and then it's gone up in increments. I think to go up to $10.45, it either already did or it's on its way there. You know, which is something, but it's short of you know, the $15 an hour that you're seeing put in place in Seattle or Los Angeles, and it's well short of the living wage of around $20 an hour in either the capital region or Vancouver. Lower mainland, I think, was a bit over $20 an hour for a living wage. So you know, minimum wage has gone up a bit, but it's stuck. At the same time, the welfare rates, you know, what we do to help people out at the very bottom, they've been frozen since 2007, and before that, they were frozen for quite a while as well. You know, so that's 8 years without a raise at a time when you know, everything's been getting more expensive. You know, they've made some sort of minor policy changes in the last little while to the welfare system. You know, they allow people to keep more of the money they earn, and they ended the clawback of money from child support payments to single parents who have kids. But you know, those are sort of small things that would help a small number of people. You know, they were positive, but uh-huh. But it's not not the same effect as increasing support across the board would have.
What this book does is it, I guess it gets us started on a conversation as to where we are and where we're going, and whether you're on the left or the right, you can sort of, you know, you can have a discussion as to, how to vote in the next election, say, and how to address these sorts of issues that you raise. Now, in the previous election, Adrian Dix, when he was the leader of the NDP, had inequality as one of the had forefront in the issues that he was running on. Do you think, in terms of just, say, pure politics, the way one votes in this province, that if you elect one party as opposed to the other, that issues that you raise in the book, the sort of reality that we're in, those would change right away?
I'm not sort of wearing rose-colored glasses that way. I do think Adrian Dix talked a lot about inequality, especially when he was running for the leadership of the NDP. I'm not sure how big a factor it was in the actual election. Elections in many ways are murky things where all kinds of issues get raised. You remember there was the whole Kinder Morgan mm-hmm. piece of it. I think there's a charisma piece of it. Do people vote for people they want to see on television for the next 4 years? There are all kinds of factors. Plus add in the fact that almost half the people in the province didn't vote. At the same time, elections elsewhere you sort of draw conclusions from things. You look at the Alberta election. Was that about inequality? I mean, some people have that read on it. It was also about throwing out Jim Prentice and the Progressive Conservatives. You look at the recent election in the UK. Again, inequality was a factor. But it's hard to know, was it the decisive factor? I'm not sure. And I think in the BC election, I think it was a piece of it, but I don't think that the NDP was as strident on as they might have been. And I think part of that is it does depend where the public is. I think the book is largely about changing minds across the spectrum, right? This is just sort of common sense stuff. It's not really left or right as far as I'm concerned. It makes the case for, what's happened in the province and what it means for us, and, makes the point that we'll get the governance that we demand as a population.
So we have, as a public, been complacent about poverty, haven't we? I mean, I don't know if it's complacent, but it was certainly indifferent to it.
I don't know. I mean, it comes up in ways where people are concerned. I do think there's been a lot of concern about homelessness, for instance, over the last decade or more, especially in the Lower Mainland and especially in the Capital Region. So that's a symptom of poverty. You have all kinds of people who volunteer at things like food banks or soup kitchens who, are obviously concerned about people in need. Does that turn into, the political motivation to do things like help people out through income assistance so they have enough money so they can pay for a place to live or food? So far it doesn't seem to, but I do think there are a lot of people who are concerned, and I think we don't necessarily frame it as poverty. We frame it as homelessness or a housing crisis, or we talk about debt levels. But I think it is a recurrent thing.
And then, do you think that the media, do you think they have a part in terms of how attention is being paid by the public?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, if there's coverage of things like homelessness or the rise in food bank use or child poverty rates, that gets communicated to the public. At the same time, in the media, we're sometimes like crows, and if there's a shiny object, we're on to the next thing, and it can be hard to have sort of sustained interest in something. Which is why, for me, it was nice to have the time to focus and write a book. Instead of working at, 400 words or 800 words as I do for a normal Tahi story, it was an opportunity. Well, first with the series I wrote that led to the book, to write, sort of 10 pieces that were 15,000 words, and then to use that frame to write something that was, 70,000 words, and brings in a whole bunch of things in a way that where you can tell a coherent story. I think is a nice thing.
Yeah, I mean, your work in this book and your work at the Tahi, that's been hailed as outstanding investigative journalism. You're able to spend a lot of time looking at these issues. I mean, a lot of your colleagues in the press can't. So, as a media consumer, as the public, as a citizen, do you think we're underserved by the media that we have today?
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much I want to criticize the rest of the media. I would say there are lots of people working in mainstream media in BC who would be totally capable of doing the kinds of things I do. But I do think it's, a business model of doing less with less. You look at attrition from media jobs and, even around the press gallery at the legislature, where publications that would have had two or three reporters in the past are down to one. The province doesn't even have a reporter at the legislature anymore. They used to have a couple. They have Mike Smith, the columnist, but that's it. So, you know, it largely is an economic thing or a financial thing where the media is, you know, run to make money and turn a profit, and doing the kind of work that I do where it doesn't necessarily turn into a story every day is more expensive, I think. And I think also the internet helps in that, you know, you can put things up when they're ready. There's not this thing that's going out to be put onto paper where it all has to fit between the ads and it has to get there at a certain time every day. You know, the internet provides a little more flexibility for writing things the length they need to be written and timing as well. You know, you can put something up in a hurry when you need to, and you can slow it down when you need to. So I do think there are advantages that allow me to do what I do, and I also think there are lots of people out there who are doing good work and who could do more if they were given the time and resources and leash to do it.
Now, in the book, you talk about these people that are sounding the alarm as to what's happening between the gap between the rich and the poor, this growing inequality in the province. And what, I don't know if it surprised me, but people on the left obviously are talking about it, but people on the right as well. There is some consensus, isn't there, as to where we are?
Well, I think globally, like I say, the statistics are pretty clear. And so, yes, you have people like Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, who used to be the governor of the Bank of Canada, saying it's a big issue. Ed Clark, when he retired from the TD Bank, said it's the number one issue facing Canada. The World Economic Forum globally said it's the number one threat to the global economy, you know, this growing gap. Christine Lagarde at the IMF, Janet Yellen at the Federal Reserve in the U.S., Warren Buffett, you know, has said he doesn't pay enough taxes, and that there's something unsustainable about the way things are being managed. So yeah, no, I'd say internationally and within Canada, there's a consensus, and within BC even, we had the BC Business Council put out a report a couple years ago about sharing prosperity, where they concluded that growing inequality was a problem, and that a lot of people were feeling, you know, left out of. You know, the riches of the province. You know, they see economic activity and wealth all around them, but they don't get a share, and therefore feel less attached to the province and the country, and that this is a problem.
You also in the book talk about race and gender, which I think is important if you're having a discussion about how a society is and what's happening within it. We seem heretofore to be reticent to call it out, to call it for what it is. But I mean, if you are white, if you are male, it is easier for you to make a go of it than say if you're an immigrant or someone who's First Nations.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and able-bodied as well.
Yeah.
I might want to add that in.
Yeah. So what sort of conversations do we have to have from here on in?
There was part of me, like when I wrote the series, I stayed away from the demographics of it a bit, just because it seemed like a big, complicated knot. On the other hand, like as a straight, white, able-bodied, middle-aged male, you know, it's easy to ignore sort of who wins and loses. But I do think, you know, conversations about, you know, the gap between what men are paid and what women are paid make a difference. You know, there are all kinds of statistics in the book about how, you know, people who come to Canada from other countries who have the exact same education as people who, you know, are second generation or third generation, you know, make significantly less money. And you know, it's not really explainable in terms of merit or anything else like that. First Nations is a huge piece of it as well. You know, we've been through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission stuff recently, and I think there's recognition of you know, how it was sort of official policy to break the culture. You know, people were using the word cultural genocide in the last few weeks, and some people have been using that term for years as well. And I think there's growing acceptance that something has been done there, and more restitution is needed. The other big line is between, you know, adults and children as well. You know, the rates of child poverty are high. And I mean, the, you know, sort of the ends of the spectrum in the province would be sort of, you know, white middle-aged men at one end and female Aboriginal children at the other. And, And I do think it matters, you know, who the people are who end up in the different positions in the economy.
Yeah, I mean, in Vancouver, there's a great deal of talk about affordability and who can afford to buy a house. And I mean, some of that discussion, I mean, centers around race sometimes.
Yeah. It's well, you're talking about this idea that it's, you know, money from China coming.
Yeah, or that you that the people who have $1 million are the only ones who can buy houses, say.
Yes, yeah, and that, and I think in the book I look at it more as a generational thing.
Yeah.
You know, people who were in a position to buy a house, say, 30 years ago, have done very, very well and have ended up, you know, sitting on something that's worth a lot of money, whereas people who are, you know, arriving now without means, and I mean, there are lots of people who come from elsewhere who have, you know, piles of money to spend on real estate here, and you know, there's been all the observations about it being sort of an investment haven as well. But for people, you know, coming out of school, perhaps with student debt, or arriving without piles of money, it's a big barrier to getting into the housing market. And if that's the main way that people in our society build wealth, then it's you know, it'll be interesting to see how that works out for people over the next few decades.
You also talk in the book, and I thought it was quite interesting how you talk about your own personal situation, your household. I mean, you and your wife both have incomes, and you tie that in to say that the idea that getting a job just isn't enough. And you also, I found quite interesting that when you talk about your two friends, someone who makes, say, low five figures as opposed to the friend that made six figures, and yet they still had similar problems in terms of say, what their future would be and how to make ends meet in the interim.
Oh, yeah, in some ways we're all human. And in some ways it's math problems, right, of, like, you know, how much money is coming in is a piece of it, and how much money is going out is another piece of it. With my own personal situation, I think we've been in the middle for several years. After we had kids, my wife stayed home and looked after them, and she went back to work fairly recently. So for quite a few years, I think our household income was below the median, and now we're somewhere above it, but not hugely above it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think, you know, where you are in the economy does affect how you see things, and I just wanted to be transparent on that, you know, that I wasn't coming at it from a point of view of, you know, total poverty and anger in one hand, and on the other hand, you know, not from a position of total entitlement either. I just wanted to be clear about, you know, where I was positioned in it all.
And in terms of the two friends that you talk about in the book, I mean, how this province is, how unequal we are, sort of says how happy we are, doesn't it?
I think wasn't there a study recently that showed Vancouver was, people in Vancouver were the least happy in, I forget if it was Canada or North America or something like that. But I, you know, I'm a bit suspicious about how they were measuring. Yeah, I mean, there are, you know, I do think it's possible to be, you know, happy with less, and it is possible to be unhappy with more, and the opposite is true as well. It's probably easier to be happy if you're financially comfortable, but it's not necessarily a determinant. And then, again, I'm not sure how you measure happiness or satisfaction. You know, there've been attempts, but I'm not sure how convincing they are. So yeah, when we talk about income and wealth, we're usually talking about money as opposed to anything else at this point.
So what happens? I mean, you're an observer of politics in the passing scene. Does it get worse before it gets better?
You know, I think probably the pendulum is swinging back already. I think people recognize there's a problem and that we need to do something differently. I think, you know, you look back at this province in 2001 when the new government came in, and the first thing they did was cut income taxes by 25%, which, you know, sounds great, but it helps people who make a lot of money a whole lot more than it helps people who don't make any money. And at the same time, it hamstrings what government can do. And so remember, there were all kinds of cuts sort of those first few years. And then they sort of stabilized out a bit, got governed a little more liberally since then. And I think, as I said, in the last couple of years, with raises to the minimum wage and some attention to this, there's an interest at least. And housing, I don't know, are we getting worse on homelessness? I was in Vancouver a couple of weeks ago, and I think I counted 10 or 12 people in sleeping bags on a Tuesday morning within a block or two of on Granville Street. It seems to me we still have a problem there. I don't know that it has to get worse. I think people already recognize there's a problem. But it does want for action, for sure.
Yeah, and as I said, the book is not without hope.
No, it's very deliberately optimistic. One of the main points is that for governments or individuals who want to do something about this, there are many, many, many options. It's not like we don't know how to deal with these issues.
Andrew, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm a great admirer of your work, and this is a hell of a book. Congratulations on it. I hope a lot of people read it.
Well, thank you, and thanks for your help letting people know about it.
You're very welcome. The book is called A Better Place on Earth, A Search for Fairness in Super Unequal British Columbia. It's from Harbor Publishing. Do pick it up. It's a lot of information in the book that I guess we sort of already knew but weren't really paying attention to, and we ought to. Its author, Andrew McLeod, joined me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.